Hi, guys. Here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath. Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK. Cygnos.
He was a preacher who couldn't resist temptation.
The priest is accused of killing Sister Margaret Ann Paul in the chapel.
The strongest of cases against a powerful preacher in a town of true believers.
The legal age for marriage is at puberty. I'm not married to any teenage girls who don't want to be. I'm 74 years old.
I don't remember reading that in the Bible, sir.
You don't know anything about the Bible.
And he kept stabbing and smiling.
410 wounds, scars upon scars.
You're listening to Seven Deadly Sinners.
Welcome back to another episode of Seven Deadly Sinners. I thought that this would be the final part in the series on Jane Hula Hoop Hair Whaley. Seriously, like dolphin training hoops at SeaWorld, Jane Whaley's hair enters the room before she does. Okay, I know it's an obscure visual, but if you close your eyes, you can picture it. So, when I was on page 20 of writing this, though, I realized that I was well on my way to a two-hour episode, and that was just too long. So, I decided I needed to finalize this ongoing horror story of Jane Whaley into four parts. There's so much I just couldn't leave out. I'm too invested in the lives of the victims to cut the stories I've already set up short. These last two episodes are going to be a roller coaster of emotion. At parts, you'll feel all warm and cozy and hopeful about family and forgiveness. And then at other times, you're going to want to call and report them to the FBI yourself, out of absolute fear of what these people have done and the final devastation they may be capable of. Some ex-members will have happy endings. Some are wandering the streets lost as all get out, and with good reason. But I only hope and pray that Jane Whaley will not go out in a cyanide-laced blaze of glory. She's already done her damage here on Earth. Damage to not only her loyal followers, but the morale of an entire town. I mean, she really knows how to ruin a vibe. You know the people that can suck the air out of a room with their negativity? Jane Whaley has managed to even suck the innocence out of a beautiful little southern town of Spindale, North Carolina. And how do I know that? Well, I spoke to someone who lives there, who's not at all involved in Word of Faith Fellowship and frankly wouldn't fit in anyway, which she should be damn proud of. I recorded the call, and with her consent, we'll be playing snippets of it throughout this episode to illustrate just how far-reaching Jane's destruction and manipulation goes. For privacy and safety reasons, as you're going to hear the most shocking info yet on what Jane and her cohorts are capable of, I'm not including her name. I will also be keeping some locations vague to protect non-Word of Faith Fellowship local business owners who have risked their own lives to help terrified escapees. Okay, so let's talk about what it's like to live in a town largely overrun by a cult.
I have so many questions about what it's like. So are you from Spindale, or are you just in like Rutherfordton County? Or
okay, so I'm from Florida.
Okay.
And I moved up here like 2 years ago. And I think I sold my house around 9 months later. And then we moved here permanently. I was like, okay, we're here for good. And whew. What an adjustment. I mean, yes, it is a creepy feeling because everywhere you go, if you know what you're looking for, you'll see them, because especially the men, they're super easy to identify because they can't wear really anything other than like a white shirt or a blue shirt, right? And so you can spot them, and they're not supposed to wear jeans, so they're usually in, you know, nice like
khakis.
Yeah, like khakis and like work, like almost like they're allowed to wear work pants when they're working.
Uh-huh.
So they wear like the Carhartt, like cargo things, but I don't even think they're supposed to wear those. Like, I mean, then the children, I don't really know. And it's strange because you don't ever drive by, because you can see the street that the church is on, but you can't see the church. So, because the street's right off of the highway.
Mm-hmm.
So if you turn and then you turn onto the street, there's a house to your right, a house to your left, and then a little bit of woods to the left, and then probably like 6 or 7 houses, and maybe even less. And then you're coming up to a gate, and you can't really see beyond that gate. And I would assume that's where everything is. But so the driveway, it like goes downhill a little bit, and she has it blocked off at the top, so you can't go down. But mm-hmm. you also can't really get out of the car and do anything because everybody comes out of their house. So the kids will run inside if they see a car that's not supposed to be on that street that they don't know, or uh-huh. a car that has, you know, like something hanging in the mirror or like a license plate on the front or anything like that. So anything they don't know, they just run from. And then the parents will come outside and it's just almost threatening. Like you just need to turn around and just
go. That's so creepy.
And it's open carry here, so, like, that's also frightening as fuck. And they just walk around. You can have, like, guns on you. And, I mean, I don't know if they're even supposed to, but I'm come on.
Mm-hmm. And that's crazy.
More than enough people say that you just keep your mouth shut and you don't say or do anything because they're so dangerous. Like, the locals here are adamant on how dangerous that they are.
Then she goes on to tell me about a man who had tried to escape Word of Faith Fellowship. And this wasn't the first time this had happened.
And the guy ran in just screaming, they're going to kill me, and that he needed to hide and everything else. And the guy that owned the restaurant put him in his car and he was like, just stay here, blah, blah, blah. And later took that male that ran in to either Charlotte or Raleigh, I can't quite remember, but took him out of the area and put him in a place to stay and helped him get on his feet and find his way somewhere else. But the guy was running from the church in the
mm-hmm.
in the direction wow. of the restaurant, ran in. From two different people was told he went in through the kitchen, like flew into the kitchen, and was just like hollering about needing help and everything else. And he needed to hide. And I guess the guy that owned the place, it wasn't the first time something like that had happened.
Wow.
So he already had a preset plan. And
that's so nice of them to help.
Yeah, I think he repeated the plan a couple times with people.
It's no surprise, based on what we know from prior episodes and then this local account, of the fear escapees feel. And Michael Lowry would be no exception. After Michael Lowry's brutal stints in the lower building, where he was beaten unconscious, forced to sleep outside in freezing temperatures, and continually blasted and ridiculed for being too effeminate, the sweet, now 18-year-old boy vowed that he was going to escape and be a voice for other young boys, telling the world about being imprisoned and tortured in the lower building. And he was about to make good on that promise with a little help from soon-to-be friends on the outside. You see, years prior, John Huddle had escaped Word of Faith Fellowship, gotten back on his feet, and even started a blog called ReligiousCultsInfo.com, exposing dangerous cult-like church leaders such as Jane Whaley, and giving other escapees resources and hope. Upon his escape, he stayed in the small town of Spindale and wasn't about to let any young kid go at it alone on the outside. Especially kids that grew up almost completely within the church, so sheltered from the outside world that they never even owned a cell phone. And a trip to purchase a cell phone would be where John Huddle would hear of Michael Lowry and vow to help him. It was in this cell phone shop that another former Word of Faith Fellowship member would spot Michael and alert Huddle of the boy's escape. Huddle had a vague recollection of the boy from their joint time at Word of Faith Fellowship, so he gave him a call. Michael was staying at a motel at the time, with almost no money or life experience. Huddle could tell Michael was in trouble. He asked if they could meet that moment and offered to pick Michael up. They drove to a Chinese buffet, ate, and talked. As they chatted, Michael told Huddle of the lower building.
The what? Huddle responded. The building down the hill from the office? Michael nodded. As Michael recounted the horrific abuse he endured in the building, Huddle was shocked. Jane Whaley was always a monster, but this escalation of literally imprisoning young boys and men was a level he didn't even expect Jane to evolve to. I know the building, but I didn't think they used it like that when I was there, Huddle said, then pulled out a pen and paper to record exactly what Michael was saying, and the building layout. That's where the bunk beds were, Michael said, and that's where I slept, and that's where they did the blasting. How long were you there? Huddle asked. I'm not sure about the first time, but the last time I was there from August to just the other day when I left the church, he said. Huddle couldn't believe what he was hearing. Jane Whaley had to be stopped. Maybe if Michael was willing to go public, they could finally take her down and save hundreds of lives from being ruined. After their meeting, Huddle didn't think Michael should be alone, so he arranged to have Michael's brother drop off his clothing, and then Huddle stayed with Michael that night, concerned for the boy whose childlike demeanor was very evident to Huddle. This boy needed to be looked out for until he could adjust to the outside world. The next day, Huddle then arranged for Michael to stay at a Faith Freedom Fund member's home about 45 minutes away. And then Nancy Burnett entered the picture. She was a court-appointed advocate for foster children who had previously had a very disturbing run-in with the Word of Faith Church when she was asked to look over the adoption of two young brothers to an older couple within the church. As a survivor of child abuse herself, Nancy was determined to look after young people who didn't have a voice for themselves. And Nancy was instantly worried. When she went to check on the boys, the normal, upbeat, energetic little boys seemed lethargic and dazed. And when she entered the church and saw the congregants jumping around and screaming during a service, and then saw that this didn't even wake them out of their trance, she knew something was very wrong. But as the thought entered her mind, Jane and her entourage headed toward Nancy. Jane scowled at Nancy. "My daughters have heard from God that you are here to cause strife in our church," Whaley said. "You can come visit here, but you can't be here if you're not here with a pure heart and good intentions." Nancy, hopefully as sarcastically as I picture it, said, "Well, I'm sorry they heard that, but they're wrong. I'm here to observe the boys." Jane, throwing a tantrum that her fake efforts were not being acknowledged, said, "We played songs specifically for you and your supervisor because we knew everybody knows those songs. You didn't even bother participating." Nancy, "Ma'am, I'm not here to participate in your service. I'm here to observe. That's my job. I'm sorry if you're offended, but I'm not here to worship. I am here to observe the boys." Jane fumed. "God gave us these boys. DSS gave us these children," Whaley screamed, getting right in Nancy's grill and shaking her witchy finger in her face. Jane, "You are wicked. You are here to cause strife. You are here to judge us. You don't think these kids are supposed to be here." Then Nancy had to put her arm up to block Jane. "You need to take about 3 steps back," she said. "You are entirely too close to me right now." Furious, Jane marched away. But that didn't stop her foot soldiers. They circled around Nancy and yelled. And then a law enforcement man walked by and flipped open his coat to expose some sort of badge. "We have to get out of here," Nancy said. Nancy glanced at her supervisor. "No, we have to go now. This is out of control. But we will be back," Nancy warned the congregants. Nancy leaned down to the little boy about to speak, but the little boy spoke first. "Miss Nancy, please don't leave me." Nancy's heart broke in two as she said, "Buddy, Miss Nancy has to go right now, but I'll be back, I promise." After that, Nancy was on a tear. She was determined to get justice and expose Word of Faith Fellowship. She bought court records about cases against Word of Faith Fellowship and saw egregious settlements and favors given to Jane by the courts. "This is insane," she thought. Huddle called Nancy to meet with him regarding Michael. They met at a restaurant that served alcohol, as they knew Word of Faith Fellowship spies wouldn't be caught dead in a restaurant filled with booze devils.
Like, so the bar is like a safe spot because technically they're not supposed to be anywhere that serves alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
So the bar is easy. because most of the people that are in there aren't, you know, this is crazy because I've worked in bars my whole life and I can't tell you that people in bars are the more normal ones, but in this town, it's that way. Like,
yeah, I believe it.
From the moment Huddle and Nancy met, they knew they could trust each other. Neither was intimidated by Jane Whaley. Huddle told Nancy about the abuse Michael suffered, and Nancy agreed they needed to go to the police, which Huddle informed her Michael was willing to do. Nancy then called Michael, and he opened up about everything. Then on January 11th, 2012, Michael went to the police. When a month later, he nor Huddle had heard anything back, though, Huddle called the station and found out that the officer never filed a report. With pressure from Huddle and Nancy, finally, a misdemeanor charge was filed. But it was watered down to say this. Church members held Michael down, hit him about the face and chest area, and then let him go. The officer wrote that Michael said the reason they did this was because he was a homosexual and they were trying to get him to stop being a homosexual. The report named 6 church members involved in the attack. Oh, okay, so that should clear things up. They were simply trying to beat the gay out of him? Just a simple misdemeanor? This churched up explanation was not enough, though. What they did to Michael was a serious crime. So they kept fighting and added another bulldog to their team. Robin Spence, the clerk of Rutherfordton County Superior Court, a woman known for her no BS ballsy attitude, the right woman to help. Nancy called and asked her to meet her in the parking lot of a Dollar General to talk about the Word of Faith Fellowship Church. The tough woman in her early 40s was not one to back down from a fight, especially one she believed in with her whole heart. So Robin Spence said, I'll be right there. She, too, had run into issues with Word of Faith Fellowship before, and now the threesome, Nancy, Robin, and Huddle, weren't going anywhere. In the parking lot of the Dollar General, Spence got right down to business. I used to work for a lawyer. He was one of the first people to win a custody case against the church, Spence said. The church is dirty. They are abusing people inside that place. And when somebody challenges them, they will fight to the end. They'll do anything to get their way. Well, I'll tell you this, Nancy said. Nothing pisses me off more than someone mistreating children. Me too, Spence agreed. I have to stay professional, though, because of my position. There's only so much I can do. But you seem to have the balls to stand up to these people, and I hope you will stick to this. I'm not afraid of them, I promise you that, Nancy said. Spence smiled. Well, I can help you, but I won't break the rules. I can tell you where to go, where to look, but you need to be careful. These people have money and connections. They have a bad reputation about harassing people. You have to watch your back. And Robin Spence was right. On my phone call with the Spindale resident, she dropped this bomb on me.
It's frightening, yeah. And they're all throughout here. I mean, you hear that they're doctors in the hospital here. You hear that they might own
part of this. They're in law enforcement.
Yeah, they're throughout law enforcement, they're throughout the court. Like, they own attorney businesses, they own doctors, they own who knows what else. It's just, like, it's scary because most of the locals say not to go to the hospital here, like, to just go out to Spartanburg or Shelby. I believe they keep it all in-house, you know. They have their own doctors, they have their own attorneys, they have their own accountants,
And that's crazy that the locals literally say don't go to the hospital or a doctor here because they know that there's something up.
Yeah. Yeah. And that was like when I first got here. Yeah. And I was like, yeah, that's funny. Like, whatever. You know, I'm thinking you're just a drunk. Like, what are you telling me? Like, whatever. And then as I was here longer, I'm like, huh, maybe they are right.
Wow. Maybe,
you know, and I had to go into that hospital to pick someone up and, I couldn't help but just think that any doctor that walked by, like, just could be in Word of Faith.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they all fit the look. So once you start thinking like that, it's like, oh, are you?
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the ones I do know, like, the faces of. I've seen, like, out food shopping, and it gets me.
But Word of Faith's sinister ways were about to reach new heights. In August 2012, a man named Kevin Logan walked into Robin Spence's office. She had never seen him before, and he was acting strange. He quickly closed the door behind him and pulled up a chair. Speaking in a low voice, he said to Robin, "Somebody hired me to kill you. They offered to pay me $10,000. Spence was stunned. "What the fuck?" Before she could say a word, Logan reassured her. "Don't worry, I'm not going to do anything to you," he said. Logan explained he was contacted by a middleman who was hired by a Word of Faith Fellowship member to do the job, to murder Robin Spence. Word of Faith Fellowship wanted her out and then wanted one of their own to take her job. "Why are you telling me this?" she asked. "Because I remember you. You used to be a social worker, right? I remember you helping my family. I know you are a good person. That's why I came here to warn you. People are out to get you. You need to watch your back." Then he left. Holy shit. Jane Whaley and her cronies are now in the business of murder? Spence was clearly shaken up and called a few people she knew in law enforcement, crying and scared. But she was waved away by Sheriff Francis telling her she was basically being a wuss. Spence's boyfriend was a sheriff's deputy, though, so she ran home to tell him. He immediately contacted the State Bureau of Investigations, and just like that, Sheriff Francis was suddenly interested in taking the case. What a coincidence. Robin was still terrified, though, constantly looking over her shoulder. She told Huddle and Nancy that if anything happened to her, it wouldn't be an accident. But the brave threesome kept pushing. I mean, with this new info, what else was the Word of Faith capable of? They pushed and pushed for North Carolina law enforcement and the courts to take Michael's case seriously. During all of this, one positive, though, that they were able to accomplish was scaring Jane into shutting down the lower building. They put heat on her, and she was not about to be caught. Okay, so the following is a direct quote from the book Broken Faith. They did their research, they spoke to all involved, so this is the best way for me to convey what happens next to you. Quote, "It had been a year and a half since a man had walked into Robin Spence's office and told her he'd been hired to kill her. Quote, "It's an active investigation," was all she was told. In the meantime, Spence suspected someone had broken into her home to plant listening devices and snoop through her things. She refused to talk openly on her own telephone or in her office. It seemed that people were following her. She wondered if she was becoming paranoid, if the frustration was fraying her sanity. Desperate, she reached out to a group that helps people escape cults. She sent a private Facebook message to Families Against Cult Teachings on January 29th, 2014. She said, "I am an elected clerk of the Superior Court in North Carolina, and we have a cult here in my small town. I am the only person, elected that is, in my county who has tried to help the individuals who have escaped this horrible place. They hate me and have caused me and my family so much trouble because I have tried to help. I currently have a bounty on me. We have gone to law enforcement, SBI, and the FBI with no help," she wrote. "They have endless amounts of money and power. I am about the only elected official that they cannot control. We have nowhere else to turn. No one will help. They have cost me thousands of dollars in attorney fees trying to have me removed from office." If you have never read about the Word of Faith Fellowship in Spindale, North Carolina, please Google it. I am sure you will find them just as scary as the other cults you speak of. If you ever have any advice that could help the survivors of this cult on how to get justice, please let me know. The group's director studied up on Word of Faith, then contacted Spence. He believed she was in danger. His group would decide what to do to help her. Meanwhile, an executive director within the group wrote back to Spence. "Hi, Robin. So sorry to hear you are going through this horror. Can you send us specific information about what this group has done to harm its members? We can't give advice unless we specifically know what this organization is doing / how they are treating their followers. Also, how did you find out there is a bounty on you? Are you hiding because of it? I'm not hiding, she wrote back. I won't let them intimidate me. I am a well-known public figure here, so they will have to be very smart on how they will succeed in killing me, Spence wrote. Robin then encouraged them to speak to Nancy, and they did. They wrote, I spoke with Nancy today. This story is absolutely incredible. These charlatans and abusers must be exposed. Great. I'm glad you spoke with her, Robin wrote on February 5th. She is a wonderful person who has only tried to help. We cannot trust anyone here. Thank you again. It was her last message to the group. The next week, Robin Spence began suffering from flu-like symptoms. She died on February 16th, 2014. She was 46 years old. No autopsy was done, and the official cause of death was acute respiratory distress syndrome. Spence's family asked Sheriff Francis to investigate her death as suspicious. He refused. End quote. If at any point you've questioned the morality of Jane Whaley and the company she keeps, I hope you've now got your answer. Robin Spence was a brave and moral woman with guts and gumption, and she put herself on the line to help people like Michael break free and live the lives they deserved to live. But sadly, just a casual possible murder wasn't slowing these scumbags down. Because then, Michael disappeared. His current social worker received a text from him saying that he no longer needed their services. Worried, she notified all involved in the case, including Nancy and Huddle. How strange. Michael seemed to be so excited about his future, and he was doing well. They called, went to his new apartment, looked around town, and nothing. They hoped and prayed that the pressure of all this hadn't gotten to him and he took his own life. They called his family outside the church and new friends he'd made on the outside, and no one had heard from him. Days later, still nothing. So Nancy did the only thing she could think of left. She called a reporter from the Associated Press. On gut reaction, the reporter went straight to Word of Faith Fellowship. Surprisingly, Jane welcomed him in. This was odd, as outsiders are never allowed inside. Jane turned on her southern charm. How that's effective or real, I'll never know. And then she offered him a tour of the church and the school and even the Holocaust Museum. She said she created it in the aftermath of the church's victory over DSS. She equated her religious persecution to the systematic destruction of 6 million European Jews during World War II. She told a well-known reporter from an extremely well-known publication this. Then, as if likening herself to a mass genocide of innocent people wasn't enough, Jane told the reporter that Michael was simply in the basement of the church, and he would love to talk to the nice gentleman from AP. But Michael was only allowed to talk if she and other church leaders were present. When the reporter entered the room, Michael didn't seem okay. He was fidgeting nervously. And like a robot, he recited the coached words that he initially ran away from the church because his parents discovered he was using a computer to look at pornographic images. He then apologized for filing charges, hurting his family and harming the fellowship. Quote, I know I'm going to have to pay for the things that happened. Unknown to the reporter and others, Michael had been tricked into coming back to the church, lured by a text message from his brother that said their mother was seriously ill. Michael hated the church, but he loved his mother. He told his brother where to pick him up. When he arrived at his parents' home, he discovered his mother wasn't sick at all, and they wouldn't let him leave. They never left him alone, not for a minute. He had no phone, no transportation, no way out. Michael had essentially been kidnapped. They destroyed Michael's sense of hope. and I hate them for this. Michael eventually got out, but they messed with his mind. I mean, the lingering trauma has to be so substantial. Again, I hate them for this. But I'll bring you back up a tad. Well, it's going to take a bit, but we'll get there. Okay, fine. A forced marriage isn't ideal, but I'm grasping at straws here, people. Okay? Back to the Cooper family. John David Cooper woke up the morning of April 30th, 2013, his wedding day. He was marrying Jessica Fields, a girl he always thought was cute and had a crush on, someone he would have liked to have dated, and even fantasized about kissing her or holding her hand. The scandal. But Jane was already on one. A new plan was in motion, as Jane doesn't do anything without intent. She was now hell-bent on arranging marriages, even buying engagement rings in bulk. We discussed that in the last episode. So during one Sunday service, she called the high school age followers forward to tell Grandma Jane what was on their heart. Never before having the freedom, which clearly wasn't freedom at all though, to tell Jane or anyone that they had a crush, they lined up in droves to speak to Jane. Thrilled, Jane found another integral way to control people. Especially now, you know, she's catching them young. She was hitting two birds with one stone. By young marriages, which would then produce future children, she was essentially adding an entire new family to her cult. John Cooper stood in line to speak to Jane that Sunday and said that he'd like to walk out a relationship with Jessica. Though Jessica was adorable and petite with big, beautiful brown eyes, John knew that options were limited. Only about 10 girls his age were members at the time, and he needed to snag Jessica fast. Not necessarily wanting to marry her, hell, they had never even spent time alone, he still uttered the words he knew Jane wanted to hear. He said, "God is putting it on my heart that I want to walk out a relationship with Jessica, maybe even marry her someday." Whaley was thrilled. Whether true or not, Jane said, "Oh, wonderful, that's what Jessica told me about you." John went back to his seat, nervous but excited. Was he really going to get to date Jessica? Be alone with her? Hold her hand? That innocent excitement quickly turned to a jarring sense of no turning back now, though. Because that same day, within minutes of the boys telling Jane what was on their heart, Jane called all the newly anointed couples to the stage and uttered these words. "God has put it in the hearts of these young people that they should be married. It's God's will." And just like that, at age 16, John David Cooper and Jessica Fields were engaged. Previously in the church, young people were barely allowed to look at each other. And now with Jane's new rules, they were forcefully engaged. Sure, they grew up in the church together, but knew absolutely nothing about each other's hopes, dreams, likes, dislikes, weird habits or quirks, how each other even smelled. Yet, Jane Whaley decided these two young virtual strangers were to be married.
Hi guys, here's my morning routine. First, I drink olive oil. Next, I take an ice bath.
Ooh, feeling super healthy.
If your health advice sounds strange coming from a kid, maybe it's just strange. Cygnos pairs AI with a biosensor so you can track your body's unique responses to food, movement, and more in real time, helping you achieve your health goals. Get $10 off select plans at Cygnos.com, Cygnos.com, with code SPARK, Cygnos.
I promised you some glimmer of hope, though, didn't I? And like John Cooper, we need that right now. So one thing John did know that enticed him, besides Jessica's cuteness, was that she too wasn't as malleable as everyone else. Jessica had tried and failed to escape before. Unsure how to ever approach this, though, John went into the arranged marriage with the small glimmer of hope I said that Jessica was more like him than he thought. So on their wedding day, April 30th, 2013, not only was it nerve-wracking to be marrying someone you hardly knew, but nothing about them was involved in this ceremony. Jane's idea of a wedding was more of an elaborate show and tell of Grandma Jane and Grandpa Sam and everything they've done for the church. There were songs to memorize, custom-made dresses designed by Jane and ordered to sew by likely some unpaid laborers in the church. There were choreographed song cues for random children to sing. And most important to Vainglorious Whaley, there were prepared speeches that these two youngsters would speak from their heart toward Jane, thanking her for essentially allowing them to be a pawn in her game of manipulating lives like Sims characters. The ceremony began, and John tried to focus on Jessica. She was beautiful, and maybe in time he'd learn to love her and she him. The wedding of two young people in prison, I mean love, went like this.
Some of my mom's side of the family, her mom and some of my other aunts, cut us off and didn't want anything to do with us. And I'll never forget, Jane and Sam told us they would be our grandparents, and that's always been special to me. And Kent and Brooke up there took my cousins in, and they've been aunts and uncles to me, and Kent's been like a father figure to me, and I'm very grateful to y'all.
I was just crying out, God, I want what you have for me. Whatever it is, Jesus, that's what I want. And that's when God dropped John David in my heart at the same time that God put me in his heart. And we started walking out the relationship, and it was wonderful. And I knew it was going to be forever.
And this has been the best place for me. I love this place. And
I had always cried out for a husband that would love God, that would love me, that I could trust, that I could depend on. And God gave me that. And I count him as the most precious, precious blessing in my life. I love you so much, and I'm so grateful to God for you.
Okay, fine. Awkward, unoriginal, and cult-like, but at least John Cooper had the wedding night to look forward to. I mean, they would finally sleep in the same bed. Maybe he'd get a little action for the first time. Rick Cooper watched on as his son was forced into a marriage. Sure, Rick and Suzanne hadn't been forced to marry each other, but their entire relationship had been a mess, which only got increasingly worse under Jane Whaley's control. I mean, at this point, Rick had pretty much lost everything. His wife wanted nothing to do with him, even throwing him to the wolves, Jane, which landed him in the lower building for over a year. He had poured his blood, sweat, and tears into building his family's dream home, and he was broke. He did the math and realized that he had given any extra, though they never really had any extra, money to Jane Whaley to fund her lifestyle and her big white house with the columns. Even deeply in debt, he still tithed about $300 a month to the church, with love offerings, gifts, and additional collections taken at multiple weekly services. Rick knew that figure was much higher. He did the math, and if every member in Spindale Church alone tithed like him, $3,600 a year, Jane was making millions. She'd stolen his money, his family, and now his son's free will. He tried not to think of it and just prayed his son would have a better life than him. And John, he was also trying to focus on the positive, and that was solo time with his new wife. He couldn't wait until the rules were hammered down on them. After the corny Disney princess ceremony had occurred, John and Jessica were told this. The rules. Church leaders, quote, when you get home tonight, you can give Jessica a godly hug and a godly kiss. Then you just roll over and go to sleep. And when you're ready for the next step, let us know and we'll talk about it, they said. Back at Jessica's parents' house after the reception, they found the home filled with more people. Simply over it, at 10 p.m., John said to Jessica, I'm going upstairs. Are you coming? Jessica hesitated. Well, John said. Okay, she said softly. She followed him up and went to the bathroom to change. John put on a pair of shorts and a t-shirt, and Jessica came out wearing a t-shirt and floppy leggings. Before he had a chance to say a word, she crawled into bed and pulled the covers up to her neck and put a pillow between them. The beautiful bride earlier that day was terrified into the submission of the church. But John thought he'd shoot a shot. For God's sakes, they were now married. John walked to her side of the bed. Look, could we at least, you know, kiss? Suddenly, Jessica, what?
He didn't even have a chance to defend himself, as Jessica was already rushing to her parents' room. Within minutes, Jessica's mom was in their room and handed John a phone. He was to call church leaders, confess, and find out his next move. On the phone, he was given permission to kiss Jessica, but was told that she wasn't ready. Then continuing on, the leader said, "Don't touch her. I don't want to hear that you even rubbed against her elbow." Some fucking wedding night. John had dreams of going to medical school. John Cooper had, after all, aced the MCAT, scoring in the 90th percentile. With those scores, John could get into the medical school of his choice. There was only one problem, though. Jane had given her blessing for both John and his brother Peter to enroll in school. But they had to enroll together in a twisted sort of buddy system that Jane found acceptable in the eyes of God. Peter's MCAT scores weren't nearly as high as John's, though, and it was clear he wouldn't be accepted into the same top-tier schools. But Jane Whaley had a solution. John should take the year off and give Peter time to cram to take the test again. John reluctantly agreed and spent a year working odd jobs for members of the church. Peter received better scores the second time around, but was still unlikely to be admitted to the same schools. Jane even heard rumblings that John was being prideful about his test scores and asked a Word of Faith member, a doctor, to talk to him. Church members joined the doctor in the meeting with John and Peter, asking him why their medical school application essays didn't talk about the call of God in their lives. Then, John and his brother found themselves in a blasting session. It was settled. Members would help them write their essays to incorporate the boys' spiritual beliefs, and the essays turned into religious manifestos written by a committee. John was beside himself. No school would take this seriously. Essays were as important as test scores and grades, if not more so. It showed administrators a glimpse into the applicant's daily life, their candor, their bedside manner. There was nothing John could do about it. The church had total control. John had set his sights on the University of North Carolina School of Medicine in Chapel Hill, and he was accepted, though it wasn't looking good for Peter. Church members began to hound him about his decision. Jane said he should tell admissions he wouldn't attend unless they accepted his brother. John was appalled at the thought, but Jane was insistent that it would be the will of God. He made the phone call to admissions and spoke with Miss Reed, who told him there was nothing she could do. There were hundreds of other candidates. Jane wouldn't budge, though. But John kept insisting that he should be allowed to go to school without Peter. If it was God's will, they'd let Peter go, said Jane. John didn't want to keep pestering the admissions office as Jane commanded, so he pretended to keep calling to appease her. Eventually, the charade had become a reality, and John was forced to call Miss Reed again to request a meeting with the Dean of Admissions. She could hear the desperation in his voice, and though meeting with the dean was out of the question, she suggested she meet with John in person. She knew something wasn't right. When John entered Miss Reed's office after the four-hour drive to Chapel Hill, she seemed caring, almost motherly. He knew he could bullshit her, but for some reason, he felt he could trust her, and he opened up. "I'm in a cult," he told her, noting the incredulous look on her face. It was the first time those words had ever come out of his mouth. "They don't let people go to college alone. They want you to have a guard, so you watch each other. It's how they make sure you follow the rules. That way, they can make sure you don't leave the church. We both want to get out of the church. He's not trying to hold me back. It's the leadership that put me up to this," John explained. In shock that he was being so open with an outsider and at the tears streaming down his face. The pair talked for 2 hours. He told Miss Reed everything about the lifetime of physical and emotional abuse. She was a Christian. She told him that God loves him, that the God he was used to is not the God most Christians believe in. He needed to find a way to come to school. And so, John and his trusted brothers came up with a plan to tell Jane what she wanted to hear.
He knew he had found an ally in Miss Reed, so he lied to Jane and told her the school would be able to accept Peter after all. Jane was ecstatic. See, I told you God spoke to me about this. I knew it was God's will for you to go there today. The plan was set. The wheels were in motion. And for the first time in years, maybe ever, John felt like he could breathe. Leaving Word of Faith to go to medical school was only part of the plan. John and his brothers were ready to leave the church in their rear view mirror permanently. The Cooper brothers, John, Peter, Benjamin, and Jeffrey, had outside friends, former Word of Faith members, who gave them the courage to consider leaving. The boys had secretly began recording conversations with Jane, too. They asked her questions like, why couples can't have sex when they wanted to, in order to use her words against her and convince their wives that Jane was a fraud, making proclamations not supported by the Bible. John's wife, Jessica, had tried to leave the church once before. The other boys, though, weren't so sure that their wives would follow suit. John signed up to be a watchman, a fancy name for an overnight security guard at Word of Faith, reporting any suspicious behavior up at the church chain of command. He began to learn the timing of shift changes, how long it took church members to file in and out at weekly church services, all vital information that would later come into play. Convincing Jessica to try and flee again would prove to be difficult, though. The pair had only been married for a year, not to mention never really dating before, and they just didn't quite trust each other. There was nothing fun or spontaneous about sex once they were given permission. They lived with Jessica's parents, devout Word of Faith members, who John tiptoed around to not be tattled onto church members. So John sought the help of his cousin Danielle, who had successfully left the church years prior. And Danielle convinced Jessica life was wonderful on the outside. She would be able to come and go as she pleased, speak and sing whenever she liked. No more blasting. That did the trick. John told her he was going to medical school and wanted her to join him. He didn't care what Whaley said, and Jessica agreed. She had secretly wanted to leave for years. Their first potential roadblock, though, was getting their car title transferred into their name. If they tried to leave without doing this, the car could be reported stolen. He approached Jane about the subject, citing their need to build credit to buy a house one day. He knew they would bolt as soon as the title was transferred. But Jane was none the wiser, and surprisingly, she agreed. John could almost smell freedom. July 16th, 2014 started as any other day, until John got a phone call. The title was ready. The timing was perfect, just 2 weeks before school was supposed to start. He hurriedly got the registration switched over, and that was it. The plan was in motion. And it was a Wednesday, a church service day, and every Word of Faith member would file into the church at 6:30 p.m. that night. They had a 10-minute window before anyone would realize they were gone. This was it. This was their chance. Everything had to be planned down to the moment. At 6:10, Jessica's parents would leave the house. John told them they would follow shortly and that they had to get gas in their car on the way to the chapel. They filled the gas tank and returned home at 6:25. By 6:35, the whole church would know something was going on as the praise choruses started to fill the music hall. They had to be quick. As John shoved as many earthly possessions as he could into large black trash bags, his life began to flash before his eyes. He had joined Word of Faith when he was 18 months old. For the last 2 decades, he had been choked, punched, beaten, publicly humiliated by Jane from the pulpit, and blasted for hours at a time by congregants. He had been isolated from the outside. No television, newspapers, magazines, movies. He had been separated from his parents and 8 siblings and forced to live with other church members. John didn't know if this wasn't normal or not, but he knew that anyone who successfully fled was likely to never see their friends or family again. Life inside the church was brutal, but running away was not without its own sources of pain and risks. Bag after bag was thrown into the car. Jessica was grabbing everything she could as quickly as she could. Their 10 minutes were up. But then she ran back into the house for just one more bag. There was no more time. John was bracing for the reality, whatever that meant. He wasn't sure if Jessica was ready to be dead to her family. She was extremely close with her mother. He was worried Jessica might still believe Jane was a prophet. Jane constantly pounded into members' heads that if they left the church, they would face the wrath of God. Whether through cancer or a car accident, something awful would happen. Church members believed they would be damned for eternity. John had stopped believing this long ago. He believed their lives would get better. Finally, their car was stuffed to the roof. The doors were closed and the keys were in the ignition. All they had to do was head east toward Charlotte. Their cell phone started to ring as soon as they pulled onto the main road. They'd already agreed they wouldn't answer. A car appeared in their rearview mirror, speeding toward them. John worried it would be Jessica's father, Randy, from the church's security team, so he pushed the pedal to the metal. Jessica was shaking. When they managed to drive a good distance past the church compound and away from any headlights, John pulled the car over so they could both send text messages to their families, explaining that they were safe and that they were leaving for John to go to medical school. No turning back now. Back at the church, John's brothers, Benjamin and Peter, were setting up their instruments to begin playing worship music for the congregation when they felt their cell phones buzz. They both knew it was coming, but didn't know when. This way, they could claim plausible deniability. The boys watched the commotion unfold in the congregation. Jane questioned whether or not they knew and claimed the college devils had taken a hold of John. "God told me this would happen," she said. "Call him and say he's out of the will of God and he's going to hell if he doesn't come back." For John and Jessica, it was the first day of a great adventure. They reassured each other that this first night, that everything would be okay. The phone calls and text messages from family were never ending. John only answered one frantic call from his mother, Suzanne, who told him emphatically that he would be going to hell. She couldn't understand why he had left, so he explained that Jane was stealing his dream of medical school. He also spoke to her about the constant beatings and abuse he suffered at the hands of their prophet. Suzanne assured him if he came back, things would be different, but he knew better. His father, Rick, cut his son off completely. Maybe one day his parents would see the truth and see past the blindfold they'd been wearing all these years. Maybe it was too late. Okay, I'm sorry to leave you on such a cliffhanger, but this is the end of part 3 on everyone's BFF, Jane Whaley. I promise, next week will be the last and it will be worth the wait. Thank you so much for listening and connecting with us on Instagram at 7 Deadly Sinners Podcast. You guys are the coolest and I love hearing your stories and your connections to some of these cases. It's crazy. It's been such an awesome journey and I can't wait to keep doing it with you. Seven Deadly Sinners was written and created by me, Rachel O'Brien. Research and writing assistance by Kate Codman. Sound engineering and music production by Greg Hunter. And produced by Rachel O'Brien and Greg Hunter. Thank you for listening.